call to order the Wednesday, February 16, 2011 meeting of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Welcome, everyone. We're going to proceed slightly out of order because we have some people who have come quite a ways for 2208. And so I think we'll take that up first. So I open a public hearing on House Bill 2208. And while you're on your way up, let's see who we have signed up for that. Sue Marshall, Bob Salinger, and Liz Neeson. We have them here. And yes, please, if you could, read a summary of the Bills Act.
House Bill 2208 modifies provisions related to single energy facilities, requires review of certain applications by the Energy Facilities Siting Council, eliminates the ability of phased-in power generation sources to count as individual energy sources, declares an emergency, and fights upon passage.
Thank you. And I think you are familiar with the system here, but our committee assistant has indicated that there's been some problem with people getting too close to the microphone, so please stay
keep our distance
about half a foot away.
Okay.
Go ahead, Sue.
Thank you, Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Audubon Society of Portland and the Oregon Natural Desert Association. Bob Salinger won't be able to make it here till after 1:30, so he's not here right now. I would like to just take a moment to explain House Bill 2208 and what we're intending. This bill is being brought forward by Audubon and the Oregon Natural Desert Association. HB 2208 seeks to codify the informal criteria that is currently used by the Energy Facility Siting Commission, EFSEC, in determining when energy projects are separate projects. This corrects what we believe is an existing loophole where single energy facilities with an average capacity of 35 megawatts or more, and I just want to point out this is consistent with the existing language and consistent with the existing 105 megawatt threshold, that is for those facilities that generate electricity from geothermal, solar, and wind energy, whereby they may avoid the state siting process and go through the county process instead. Section 2 defines single energy facility and is intended to follow the list of questions that EFSEC currently applies to projects. I have attached the list of questions for your information and for your comparison with the criteria listed in Section 2, Sub 2, A through K. Three or more of these conditions would need to apply for determination of whether the proposed project would go through the state EFSEC siting process or through the county-level siting process. Generally, these conditions relate to adjacency of projects, shared financing, ownership, whether a project is phased in or timed in close proximity to each other, or would not otherwise qualify as a single energy facility. Section 4, page 7, states that applicants who apply to a city or county for the conditional use permit to construct or enlarge an electric power generating plant with an average generating capacity of less than 35 megawatts, geothermal, solar, or wind energy, and again, consistent with the 105 megawatt threshold, would be required to submit to EFSEC information demonstrating that the proposed plant is not a single energy facility or part of a single energy facility. It sets a 60-day deadline for EFSEC to make this review and determination on proposed single energy facilities. Applicants would have the ability to appeal the EFSEC determination. And with me today is Liz Neeson, who's traveled, braved the weather to be here from Bend. And as I mentioned, Bob Salinger hasn't arrived yet. But thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. We'll hold questions until, Liz, you've gone. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Benson, Co-Chair Reed, for this opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of the Oregon Natural Desert Association. I'm Liz Nyson. I'm the Energy Policy Coordinator there. ONDA is a nonprofit conservation organization headquartered in Bend with offices in Portland and Ontario. We strive to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert and represent over 1,500 members throughout Oregon. We support responsible renewable energy development and believe energy siting is in accord with our mission to ensure long-term protection of our high desert resources. One of the ways that we feel we can help promote responsible energy generation is by advocating for policies that guarantee projects are sited, permitted, and developed in a way that is compatible with our natural environment. This bill is an attempt to alleviate a permitting loophole and keep statute consistent with guidance from the Energy Facility Siting Council and other state laws. A year ago, we brought before the Energy Facility Siting Council a petition asking that they make a rule to define what constitutes a single energy facility for application of the FSAC jurisdictional threshold criteria found in Oregon rule and statute. Not only had the temporary rules guiding what constitutes a single facility for the Betsy make us aware of the need for a clearer definition, but also abuses of energy siting were identified within our programmatic area, and we realized that it was something that needed to be addressed. We found that the FSAC was operating under a working document created in 2008 to help the council determine a project's magnitude, but there was no regulatory standard that existed to define what a single energy facility was, except for the set megawatt threshold. In April, the council denied the petition. However, council members identified the need and felt it was an issue for the legislature. We decided it was our responsibility to bring this issue before you so that language can be developed to eliminate the present ambiguity in state statute. We believe this is a very important matter that requires a resolution. Conflicts over what is a single site exist, and there are differences in the two types of permitting processes for energy siting because one is intended for smaller projects and one is intended for larger projects. Defining this legislative concept will help prevent potential delays in siting and permitting, as well as assure a level playing field for developers. I appreciate your time and consideration.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to declare my callousness here, and I have no idea what you just said. It really just went over my head, and I read everything, hoping that I could understand a little bit. Could you just basically tell me who this helps and who it hurts?
I don't think that it necessarily helps or hurts anybody, but what it does do is it's going to be easier for developers and the state to know when something is a single energy facility. Because the only definition that exists right now is a megawatt threshold, and that megawatt threshold is an average capacity of 35 megawatts, or if we're talking about technologies like wind or solar, it's 105 megawatts for the peak energy capacity. That doesn't necessarily go into issues such as shared boundaries, shared transmission, shared financing, and so what this will do is, one, make it so that projects that are larger projects over that threshold will go to the state for permitting. One of the reasons why this is important is because the state has a different process than the counties. And for those large projects, having the review by the state is very important, and it's important because ODFW is involved in a way that they're not necessarily involved within the county processes. The county has a lot of public involvement within their format. There's a more thorough review that happens within the state process, sometimes compared to the county process. Counties do things differently, county by county. And the counties can and should permit those projects that are under 105 megawatts, but they don't necessarily have the resources at hand to review and permit those larger projects.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would this prevent a company from building in phases, or does this just take the last phase as the criteria of whether or not it goes before the county or the state?
What this bill will do is, within state statute, add in that criteria, which is based off of the questions that are already asked by the FSAC, and also some of the language that's used in determining what a single facility is through the Betsy. And then within the FSAC, they will determine whether or not that project needs to go through their permitting jurisdiction.
If I could add, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Sheehan, it wouldn't prevent anyone from developing at all. It just steers the project one way or another to the state or to the county for the permitting. And for those larger projects that have larger impacts, they would go through the state level and receive, we think, perhaps more scrutiny in terms of the impacts.
So they would get their siting based on the final stage of their development? Because I'm just reading a lot about the phases here, and I have to assume developers are building in phases, otherwise it wouldn't be talked about in here. But that final amount they're going to produce, that's the criteria, and it wouldn't stop them from building that in phases, even though that's their... Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, that's correct.
Further questions? The challenge, I suppose, in these rules is where you do have a facility that shares some part of the wire or some other part that truly is separate, and that would somehow be caught up in these regulations and made a shared facility. Is there any, as one goes through this, I noticed that the statute calls out any three of the list. I'm not quite sure where the three came from. Maybe you could explain how that happened. And just for your background purposes, I attempted to draft just such a device when I was working on the Betsy subcommittee. And this is a far better effort, but it's also far more complicated. So I have not sorted out those pieces. So maybe you could share with us why three, why not four? What was the thinking?
Co-Chair Benz, we use three just based on our knowledge of permitting and siting. It came from us seeking out information from people who were actively involved in renewable energy development, but we aren't necessarily renewable energy permitting experts in the same way that you might be in terms of working on things like the Betsy, and so that experience might help change this bill to be, you know, something that you could be content with. I think that the three for us is a good number because we were looking at what we had listed, and if you're sharing boundaries, financing, and transmission, it seems like that would make that one giant project. Also, if you're sharing three different necessary elements of that project, then it's likely that it is one project that should be evaluated as a whole.
And if I could just add, it may be too complex, and we'd be happy to work with the Department of Energy or others to so that there aren't unintended consequences related to these criteria. So we're open to make this work in whatever practicable way there is.
Right. The procedural differences between the over 100 and is it three megawatts and less are enormous, and so we wouldn't want to inadvertently capture smaller projects with an incorrectly crafted device. So that would be my greatest concern in looking at the bill.
Okay.
Further questions for this panel? See none. Thank you very much. Wait, is there a question?
No question.
Thank you very much. We
Thank
have
you.
Several others that have signed up to be heard on this bill, David Brown and Art Schlack.
committee chairs, members of the committee. My name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables, and we're building the or doing our best to build the solar project in Christmas Valley. I thought it would be helpful to the committee if I circulated some work that was done by a pretty wide participating group in response to Department of Energy regulations on separate and distinct. I've given you a list of who was part of that effort, and it includes utilities, developers, publics, nonprofits, City of Portland, a number of others. And then RNP and the Oregon Solar Industries Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, and Paul Wooden with Community Renewable Energy Association submitted the work of this group to the Department of Energy. Page 2 of what I gave you is that cover letter. And then if you go to page 7, there's a discussion that is approximately 2.5 pages that talk about this exact issue of what is a separate and distinct facility. And I'm not going to read it. I think that it's intended to be just a constructive example of the thinking. I will tell you that the things that were most concerning to the group were whether or not these facilities that are being called the same facility are owned by the same or related parties. Another problem was, well, if the last one is going to be regulated by FSEC, how does that affect all of the others? I mean, they're already built and operating, and in my case, my project is 5 megawatts. That's less than 1/20th of the FSEC jurisdictional limit, but I'd be required to submit to FSEC and ask if there was jurisdiction. It's another procedure. It's another 60 days. And since that would be the first project in Lake County, I can't imagine how it could be part of another facility. There's no filter here to use kind of common sense as to what are we really trying to get at. And then finally, the Department of Energy has dealt with this by regulation before. It would seem to me that because a lot of technical knowledge and understanding would be required to properly craft these rules, that it would probably be a good example of something best for regulation. Thank you.
Thank you. Art.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Art Slock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm pleased to be here today to comment on House Bill 2208. The Association of Oregon Counties is opposed to the passage of House Bill 2208, and we find that the bill as drafted would have significant impacts on county land use authority for the siting of energy facilities, imposed delays, increased fiscal impacts for the consideration of new facilities within the state of Oregon at this point. Current statute currently provides clear authority for counties and the state to review energy facilities. Counties are provided land use authority to consider the siting of energy facilities generating less than 105 megawatts, and that's installed capacity as provided by ORS 215-283 sub 2G and ORS 469.300 sub 11AJ provides for state review of generating facilities 105 megawatts and more. There's a clear separation between what is small and subject to local land use authority and what the state has jurisdiction over. The siting of energy projects is clearly a land use matter at this point. They are governed by local comprehensive plans and implementing ordinances, and FSEC, when they review a project over 105, is compelled to look at the local comprehensive plans and land use regulations in their review. HB 2208 would require a new application to FSEC prior to the consideration by a county or a city of an energy facility to construct or enlarge electric power generating facilities at this point as part of a single energy facility. And if you look at the criteria that's outlined and how it would be applied, there is, I would dare say, not a single energy facility that would not qualify. because they either share transmission corridors at this point, they are in an area that is in close proximity to other facilities, and you're not looking at the question of ownership, so phasing would be an issue, as well as if one person has a energy facility and a half a mile away somebody else would have one, this still could be considered a single site. So there are major concerns at this point over the definition of what is a single site. Certainly looking at the threshold of the installed capacity of these facilities provides an opportunity for smaller facilities to be considered at the local level and for FSEC to concentrate on larger facilities as it was when these rules were initially established. Those were FSEC was really established to look at nuclear power plants and coal generating plants. And now we've gone to the point where now we have wind turbines, we have solar, we have geothermal, we have other things at this point that come into the equation. And not everything needs to be reviewed at the state. Would call your attention to a handout that's entitled the Wind Energy Task Force Report. In 2008, the counties formed a task force to take a look at wind energy siting because there were concerns being expressed by various interest groups about the county process. We did know that some counties were looking at things through their conditional use process a little different than other jurisdictions at this point because it was and is a local land use consideration. The task force came together with input from FSEC and also the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and provided a recommendation that's in this report about how counties, what information they should require and how and the processing of applications for energy facilities within the state at this point. Those recommendations were accepted. They were supported by FSEC's staff and the commission. They also supported by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the we made a presentation before the Fish and Wildlife Commission with respect to these activities. We are in the counties are in the process of implementing these provisions to ensure that the conditional use permit process is a very due diligent process that takes a look at all the impacts of these types of facilities. So I share this with you as a demonstration of the work that the counties have undertaken to address these issues and considerations and that they're currently working on. In conclusion, Mr. Co-Chairs, the Association of Oregon County respectfully requests that the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee reject House Bill 2208. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony. I really understand sort of the arguably the sanctity and also the wisdom of having significant local influence and control. Is there any point at which the more local decisions made lots of times in lots of different localities approach the scale that they become a matter of state interest?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, there may be that threshold along those lines. It's hard to get your arms around the cumulative impact of a variety of individual land use decisions. The best vehicle to take a look at that is the adopted comprehensive plan consistent with the statewide planning goals. That plan needs to be updated, and when additional information is available, there is a responsibility to update that. So, as an example, if ODF&W has additional information that needs to be taken or should be taken in consideration, they can forward those recommendations to a county, and the county can enter into a process to consider amendments to its comprehensive plan. Just want to add, and because part of this discussion, it has to do with cumulative impacts, especially as it relates to wildlife and the like. We have ensured that the Department of Fish and Wildlife would be involved in any pre-application conferences. They would be involved in terms of reviewing applications and making recommendations that the county could implement to address the questions or issues as it may relate to wildlife habitat and the like at this point. So it's a hard one to get your hands around. You can look in urban areas. So you could take the same thing with, you know, take a look at housing. We have all these individual projects that are developed, some by different owners, some real in close proximity. So you can imagine thinking of those as being a single project. It just doesn't happen at this point. The plan's the best thing to look at.
Further questions? Are you suggesting, or I don't think I heard you suggest this, but is the 35 megawatt measure inadequate? Do you think that should be higher? Or are you saying you're happy with the 35-105 and aren't suggesting that we increase it?
Co-Chair Bentz, no, I am not suggesting that it be altered at this point. We, FSEC staff and the counties have established a good working relationship. We believe that that standard is working very well.
The difficulty then that we faced with the Betsy was, of course, making sure that we weren't handing out too many tax credits to what was indeed a single project. What this conversation is to be focusing upon is more of a land use issue or a size of the project with appropriate input issue. So what you're saying is the 35 measure is about right.
For siting purposes.
And it's a challenge of determining when we actually have a separate facility. So, well.
Chair Bentz, I just want to clarify that the Betsy is a totally separate issue from the siting of these facilities. And whether you use the same measuring stick for both is a question for the legislature, but for the land use piece, the 35 megawatts has worked well.
Thank you. Well, Representative Widener.
I mean, just thank you, Chair. And for you, Art, just real quick, because I just had a generating plant put into my county. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's actually a dump where we're taking the methane and burning it. And to me, the 35 megawatts seems a little low because there's some stuff they did there to stay at that 35 megawatt level. And it seems to me like a common GE turbine that is used lots of times is about 52 or 55 megawatts. And I wonder if we can be at that level for some of these local communities. So I wonder if we're hampering people by only being at 35. And I'd like to see if you know of any places that have had any issues with it. But I know that was one of the things they looked at when they built the plant, our facility, because they could have handled more capacity and been burning more methane from the dump.
Chair Bentz, Representative Widener, the 35 has worked, I'll say, well to date. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a separate conversation to look at the question that you raise, because it some people probably have looked at that and looked at what process you go through. The county process, the two processes, just real quickly, in the FSEC process, you have to have the answers to all the questions in detail before you ever go to hearing, okay? Sometimes it takes 2-3 years in the FSEC process. The county process is much quicker, and the county process is defined in terms of a two-stage process at this point where you can get a preliminary approval and then come back and get details on some of the things that you might not have everything, you know, at the first time, but you still can't do anything, you know, construction, until you have the final sign-off at this point. So the county process, if you will, I would say is a little more friendly to an applicant than maybe the FSEC process is, just because of the magnitude of the size of the projects and also the fact that they require all of the information up front.
Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I hope this is something that we all sort of think about. So speaking as a, I think it's fair to say, champion for renewable energy projects, and think it's a meaningful piece of the economic future of the state. And I also want to sort of think it's incumbent upon any of us who take that stand to keep a watchful eye for unintended consequences, right? And I think this is going to be a growth area for our state for the next 10 years, 20 years, 5 years, whatever. I think it's something that we got to pay meaningful attention to. And be careful that we don't sort of, forgive the pun, but sort of don't kill the golden goose. And the what I heard from you, and it took me a second to somebody just got that. It took them a second, but then they got it. See, because you have the Audubon Society over here, and then you have the Golden Goose over. Okay. So it took me a second to process it. But what I think I heard you say was, we under the current planning process, we hear from ODF&W. How is that input taken? Do we have a percentage of the time that that's acted on or disregarded or sort of somewhere in between? Do we know anything about that?
Co-Chair Bentz and Representative Smith, let me answer it this way. I can get some specific information on the last couple of, let's say, yeah, that were in, and provide that information to you. But I would offer to you in a more general way that the recommendations that come from ODF&W with respect to wildlife habitat and the like, they are the experts. And, yeah, the counties rely on the experts at this point. So we rely on the recommendations of ODF&W as it relates to wildlife habitat as much as FSEC does. FSEC looks at ODF&W and takes their recommendations and implements those. And so we do the same thing, and we involve them actually earlier probably in the process than they're involved in the FSEC process, because somebody's already got a plan basically drawn up in that, and then they get involved. And so then you keep going. We would involve ODF&W from the day somebody has the first pre-application conference, and so that ODF&W is at the table with them, and you begin to have this dialogue as to what's needed in terms of an application to address wildlife habitat issues within that general area.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, if there is a way to get full information about how we about how the experts at ODF&W are taken into account on that stuff, it'd be helpful.
Further questions of this panel? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two remaining folks signed up for this, Bob Salinger and Joe Asmundi. If I pronounce Joe's name right.
Esmond, I
think. Esmond, sorry. Esmond. Forgive that mangling of your name, Joe. Do better next time.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. I'm here today representing Portland Audubon Society, but also other Audubon chapters statewide. We do support renewable energy development in Oregon. We think it's a good thing, but we also are concerned that it be done right. We're developing, especially when it comes to wind power, the landscape faster than at any time in our history, and in places that we never anticipated we would develop. We're going to some of the most remote and important wildlife areas in the state, and that pressure is only going to grow. And so, as Representative Smith has already said, it's very important that we do it right. We don't want unintended consequences. We don't want a repeat of the dams. We don't want to find out 30 years from now that we've got into places and done harm that it's going to be very, very hard to undo. And again, we're going into places that we never really anticipated would be developed. The state deliberately set up a bifurcated system where larger projects go through FSEC and smaller projects go through the counties. And I think it's important to understand what a 105-megawatt facility looks like. The ones that have been so controversial in Steens Mountain, 405-megawatt facilities, three of them side by side, are each 10,000 acres, the size of the city of Beaverton. So these are not small facilities when we get up to 105 megawatts. They cover a large part of the landscape. Even though the footprint may be small, it's a spider web of roads and power lines and all kinds of impacts that cover the landscape. We think the state was right to go to that bifurcated system and make sure that the more large, complex projects were subject to the state review. There is an interest at that scale, without question. And we've been concerned because we're seeing projects that have been bifurcated in order to get under that 105-megawatt threshold, particularly out in the Steens Mountain. To the developer's credit, he withdrew those under pressure, but the fact was we had side-by-side 104-megawatt facilities that would have been over 40,000 acres. And there is a substantive difference between the state review and the county review. As it already has been noted, the developers have to have the entire package put together before it goes to FSEC. That's an important principle. We can see the entire project laid out. It triggers Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife review. ODF&W has a much heavier leverage when it goes through the state. Our county experience has been very, very different. It's been very hard to get information out of these processes in some cases. ODF&W has been left out of some of these processes. Each county does it differently. They're very proud of the fact that they all have their own individual ways of doing things. We keep hearing from them. Quote, if you've been to one county, you've been to one county. I appreciate the individuality, but I think from a public perspective, being able to track these things, it makes it very difficult. It's also a very different level of expertise. Most counties don't have the fish and wildlife expertise at hand. The problem is that when the state created the bifurcated system, they didn't create legislation that actually allows us to identify what is a single energy facility. There's nothing really in code that's enforceable. And so the legislation that we brought forth with ONDA simply creates a definition, an enforceable definition of what a single energy facility is. We've gone to the developers, we've gone to the counties and told them we'd be happy to work with them on that definition. If our definition isn't perfect, we're more than happy to have a discussion about what they would accept, but we think it's critical that, in fact, there be an enforceable definition. It creates a level playing field. It ensures that the most complex projects go through the state and receive the scrutiny they should receive. And it also will allow projects to go faster because it'll create less litigation, less challenges if we all are playing from the same playbook. We all know what the definition is, and we can all understand where the dividing line is. So I'll end by just noting that the ODF, that the counties have pointed out their guidelines. We don't think those guidelines are sufficient. They're 4 pages long. They're very rudimentary. We did develop guidelines for the Columbia Plateau that we hope the counties will adopt statewide. Working with the counties, working with ODF&W and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and developers. But right now, the counties have a very, very different, much quicker, much less sophisticated system for reviewing these projects. We think getting this clear will help us all. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Esmond.
For the record, Joe Esmond, IBW Local 48. I do the green stuff, and I do the politics for us, to be short. I'll be speaking to this bill and overall for the past couple of years of bills along this line, and I just want to express the level of frustration, and I'm not going to be pointing any fingers, but if we are going to tout ourselves as a solar manufacturing headquarters of the world or United States, the biggest solar array with panels is 10 blocks from my office, 800 megawatts. That's chicken feed. We need to get our act together between all the agencies and streamline this. There's a project that I could have put 60 to 100 of my members to work down south of Christmas Valley over a year and a half ago. And I am not a lawyer or land use authority. I'm sometimes some kind of a bomb thrower. But our union has trained over 2,000 electricians, and solar. Hardly one dime comes from the public sector for that. We do it ourselves as part of what we do. We have probably 50 to 100 union and non-union contractors trained in solar. We need to set for the country to do some large solar arrays. It will bring jobs for everybody and put some money into the coffers. I urge you, the legislature in general and whoever's watching, and probably get in trouble, but that's okay. We need to get our stuff together. One small example, I sat at the city of Portland recently, and I was amazed. It was a developer on a bio-liquid facility in Portland. The city of Portland provided one person from each affected agencies, got in the room, it was a public meeting, how do we make this work? You need to do this, or you need to do that. And they promised them probably within 90 days, it'll be a go. Each agency had one point of contact. How can we make this work? Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? See none. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And I have no one else signed up for this bill. Is that correct, Zach?
Yes, sir.
And make sure we have the right. Yes, so no one else signed up for 2208. I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill. I'm going to open the public hearing on actually HB 2414, 2523, and 2524. What we would like to do is call up Director Tim McCabe and Director Bob Rapine to give us a brief summary of what we're going to be hearing next.
Mr. Chair, while they're getting seated, just a note perhaps of explanation in thinking for the committee and the benefit of the folks in front of us. It's been my impression that part of our job, to reiterate what we've seen and heard before from Dr. Warner and others, is to evaluate the effectiveness of various tax incentives and economic development incentives for possible forwarding to the revenue and/or Joint Committee on Tax Credits. So that's kind of what we're undertaking to begin today with respect to the Business Energy Tax Credit, and I think they're going to get us started. Is that reasonable?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. That's an excellent way to lead off. And because the 2414 and 2523 talk about the possible transfer of administration of the energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities from the Department of Energy to the Oregon Business Department, it's great that we have the two directors here to share with us what you've been doing so far in that might provide a foundation for these discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, I am Bob Rapine, Acting Director of the Department of Energy. Apologize to you, I have a cold, so I'm a little, I can't tell how loud I'm talking. So you, Mr. Chair, and committee members, we were asked to sit in front of you to kind of talk, give you some history or background of what's going on, what's where we are today, how the process has worked historically, and what we have done in the interim to address the question of does the program transfer or not. And I'll let Mr. McCabe chime in as he chooses, and or conclude with the final comments. Let me just set the larger perspective of the program. The program, as it resides today, is with the Department of Energy. It's one of our BETSI programs of the three that exist around the Business Energy Tax Credit. One is manufacturing, the one we're talking about. One is renewable, and the other one is conservation. The manufacturing credit has gone through a series of changes, came online a little later, and has some very specific parameters that were built around it. And I think in the handout that Director McCabe has handed out to you, there's some of that historic perspective. A much more rigorous process was developed by the Oregon Legislature when it came to BETSI manufacturing credits. It requires job appropriations and tracking purposes. It talks about wages and salaries associated with those jobs. It has much more prescriptive requirements than most, if not all, of the other BETSI programs that we administer today. So because of that, it also requires that the piece of legislation that created the manufacturing program requires that the Department of Energy and the Department of Oregon Business Development work together on this. And what we have done historically and continue doing today is when a company comes to my department, the Department of Energy, to ask questions about the manufacturing credit, we quickly apprise them of the fact that the Oregon business is also involved with this, and we make that connection for them so we don't lead them down one path only to have another duplicate discussion with another agency. So we then organize or coordinate the meetings with those staff of those companies. We sit at a table with my technical staff and the people who are involved with the Betsy program, Director McCabe's staff on business recruitment activities, whatever the subject matter might be, and we have a very comprehensive discussion about the manufacturing application that they're in front of us with regarding the Betsy. We then take that information, collaborate on what our next steps are going to be. If we believe a Betsy opportunity is available to this company, we work with them to get them through the application process and move forward with the next steps that are involved in getting a final approval for a manufacturing Betsy, which does require, far different than the other Betsy programs, does require a third-party appraiser. In other words, an outside third party is contracted with, using the fees that are paid through the application process, to do a actual thorough, complete business analysis of this company to validate, in fact, what they're proposing or what they're planning on doing, in fact, can be accomplished. You might ask yourself, well, gee, that seems like shouldn't be a problem. I could tell the committee members that we've actually had numerous instances, at least two that I know of, where the review process would indicate at the end of the day that the company was not well-positioned to continue on with the application process, and they were denied effectively to come any further with the Betsy application. So it does have that check and balance process that I think the legislature were hoping for when they created the program. So, again, very cooperative process between the two agencies. We've worked on improving our MOU that we had between the two agencies to make sure we understand each of our roles and responsibilities, and that was updated as of this year with Director McCabe and myself. And then what you have in front of you is a budget note that was prepared for the Oregon Legislature that was part of my budget for the Department of Energy, where a proposal or discussion need to be developed by both agencies to determine how a transfer could come about if a transfer was to be considered. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'll conclude and I'll move that to Mr. McCabe, and then he can just talk about that document.
Okay. Thank you, Director McCabe.
Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of the Oregon Business Development Department, and I would like to say I feel fine today, for those of you that remember, and I want to thank Representative Nathan for inquiring the other day. Thank you very much. But so you can ask me hard questions today. I iterate some of the things Bob said. Our relationship between departments has been longstanding. On the onset of the manufacturing Betsy back 2007, we developed the memorandum of understanding between the two agencies, and it was our belief at that time that it was the Business Development Department's responsibility to screen these applicants because it's a very valuable tool. And our job is to look at businesses and make sure they have qualified businesses planned to qualify for these business energy tax credits. And in doing so, we worked with the Department of Energy, and we agreed that a third-party verification would be necessary. And the one of the big reasons for that is we knew that many, many companies would come forward and apply for these that wouldn't qualify. And I can say this without a doubt, we've said no to more companies than we've said yes to. I could give you a couple of examples, and I won't go into detail, but there was one company that complained vehemently about the process and how difficult it was to work with the state of Oregon, and they chose another state to locate in. They are now closed. We had another one that we felt they were leveraging our incentives to get bigger incentives from another state, which is exactly what happened. That company now has chosen to manufacture offshore in China. They've closed their facility in that other state. So I'm actually quite proud of our rigorous screening process, because the companies that have passed are all still here, and they're all manufacturing, and that's because of a relationship between the two departments. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very nice to see you both in a good relationship. Is not a surprise to us, and I'm hoping that the fact that Director McCabe, you now feel good, and Director Repine, you don't feel so good, is not, there's no correlation between those two things. The question is, I didn't hear any sort of definitive statement about yes, this would be better in the Department of Energy. Yes, this would be better in the Business Development Department. Obviously, however it goes forward, there's going to be a continued relationship. But am I wrong in thinking that often the first point of contact is the Business Development Department with respect to recruiting, and this is an important element in the work you're doing?
Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, no. We actually, the Business Development Department back in 2007 saw this as a real asset, something we could market the state. So that's what led to the Memorandum of Understanding. We've actively pursued these companies. We target companies, and some of the companies we've targeted are here today. Sanyo here in Salem, Solar World in Hillsboro, Ferrotech in Fairview, and the reason we targeted those, these are well-established companies that we feel are going to be here in the long run. The ones that came to us in the interim applying for Betsy's that were said no to were ones that we didn't target. But in answer to your question, yes, it's a tool that my department uses very diligently and with great caution.
Just a question on the. Did you have?
No,
if you were to make a list of the issues we should consider and use in evaluating this opportunity or choice, whichever it is, would you have a list of that in mind so you could say, so please?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in the document that Director McCabe handed out to you, titled to the Joint Committee Ways and Means, dated January 31st. I think you'll find in the document, toward the back end of the document, there's issues that we've raised that would be a combination of things to be aware of as far as the transfer of the program via the cost, and then I think on the back there are some risks of the transfer and other aspects to consider that we've jointly have set down and when we created this document. So we think it reflects both of our agency's opinions of if a transfer was to come about, how would it come about, and what are those associated issues around the transfer.
I might add, it was my mistake. I didn't tell Director Repine I didn't hand out the document.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did.
We were all looking.
But and again, we can provide you electronically with copies of this, but it does address exactly those things, Co-Chair Benz.
Thank you. We would appreciate copies. That would
be absolutely. Great.
I'll give the one paper copy I have to the staff, if nothing else.
That'd be great. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A couple questions you don't need to, feel free to, but don't need to answer, but written information afterwards. Don't belabor yourself too much, but it would be helpful. One is, I think this proposal is similar to how they do it in Washington State, but I've never, lived there, and I don't. But my impression is that some of their energy incentives and energy programs related to jobs run through their economic development agency. But if we could get, if there is information we could get, either any other committee member wants it, at least me, on at least Washington and how other states would do it, that'd be helpful. A second thing would be on and folks who had the Betsy before them in the last session, the last special session, may have already seen this stuff. But if we had a breakdown about home-based companies that get Betsy and out-of-state attracted companies get Betsy, and not that necessarily one is good and one is bad, but that would be helpful if we have that comparison. And in part, that's just interesting to me. Partly, it's related to if it's part of the recruitment function of Business Oregon, right, then the more it's part of the recruitment function or the more that we want it to be a part of the recruitment function, the more it makes sense to be there. The more we want it to be based in folks in Oregon companies, the more it's maybe neutral, that question, right? Both could deal with it. So that would be handy. And then third is, and then finally I'll finish with a question that I want you to answer today if you can. Third, if we can think about
the causality questions, right? I mean, we're dealing with a lot of the tax credits right now. And being able to compare one to another about which things are yielding more jobs, so as we're making these choices, we can make our smartest bets. You guys getting ever, helping us get ever better at making those evaluations would be really valuable. And then the last thing, and forgive the several questions, is I've seen a proposal to eliminate or consolidate the Department of Energy. How would this or would this not interact with that discussion?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, the bill to reformat the department, let's use that
word, okay,
would suggest that this program, along with the other financial programs, would be lifted up and, if I'm not mistaken, transferred into Director McCabe's shop. So that they would come up as a package of the of that part of the department, so they would move collectively over.
Representative Smith, members of the committee, you pose a good question. When you look at the overall BETSI program, the renewables, energy conservation, and the manufacturing, you'll find that the manufacturing historically has been the smallest part of that of all the BETSIs, and it actually shows the largest return on investment. But what we need to do and what we are in the process of doing is compiling information on the number of jobs created, the average wages, the direct jobs created, indirect jobs, induced jobs as a result of the use of these BETSIs, and the income tax, the general fund tax revenue that's generated as a result of these, because all those things should be considered when you're talking about the total program.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just real quick, because with some of the stuff that Representative Smith brought up, and one of the things I'm not sure if you guys have looked at, but one of the problems I see facing a lot of our communities, and in mine, and I know a lot of the rural communities, is the rising cost of energy. So does the department take a look at how we can drive costs down of energy? Because there's lots of families who have to decide now, do I re-register my car, or do I pay my electric bill? Because they're dealing with those type of issues. And especially in the wintertime, and I know we average out their rates and everything, but is there a concerted effort to really lower the cost of energy for individuals?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, let me answer that by talking about the conservation programs that we run. We have both the residential conservation programs under the RETC program, and we also have under the business side the business energy tax conservation program, and those are where really where if you're talking about the opportunity to not spend money for your utility bill, but would, by making improvements to your either facilities or existing home, that the energy that would save would then at the end of the day save you some money. And so there is millions of dollars worth of credit programs, which are leveraged at 35%. So to give you an idea, so for every dollar that somebody spends, the state of Oregon invests 35 cents of that using the BETSI program. So there's about a 2-to-1 ratio that comes about so of those efficiencies. So if somebody is using the BETSI program for an amount of money, that means that they're putting $2 in to create those efficiencies, either by better weatherization, better windows, better furnaces, better duct systems, a series of energy conservation activities that you would normally find in both commercial and residential applications that eventually went in place, because you usually do this through an energy audit to determine where your best energy efficiencies will be accomplished by the investment you're going to make, that the net sum of that would be reduced power bills, which in effect either saves money for the user, the homeowner, or a business that now can take those resources that they were spending for power to reinvest in some other application of their business or create other jobs. So there's a lot of that goes on through our department on a continual basis.
May I follow up,
please?
I understand a lot of those credits, and they help out a lot of people, especially in the middle class. But there's a lot of people who can't afford to go get the vinyl windows, who can't afford to. And I know people in my local district, McMinnville, they actually will go through and they've been trading off to put it into the electric bill, and there's usually a straight-across trade-off. Mm-hmm. You don't have that in every community around here. That is the city of McMinnville. You don't have it in Yamhill. You don't have it in Carlton. You don't have it in Amity that can do programs like that. And this is something that I think we really need to hit to help people out, because I don't see us building more power plants to help drive down the cost. If anything, we're making it tougher to build a power plant. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what kind of concerted effort we're putting in that industry, if there's something we can do legislatively to help you do that.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, I'm going to go a little outside of my scope of the Department of Energy that I currently hold chair in, but my familiarity with the Department of Housing and Community Services. They have weatherization programs that focuses strictly on low and mid-mod income people, so gets the people who need to have the efficiencies brought to them but cannot afford the opportunity to accomplish that for themselves. And so a tremendous amount of both federal funds and state dollars are used. We actually have used some of our ARRA funds that we were granted through the federal government and have transferred those funds over to the Department of Housing and Community Services so they could allow people who are low-income, moderate to low-income owners who could make some energy efficiency improvements in their homes that, but for the fact of not having that program, would never be able to accomplish. So replacement of windows, replacement of furnaces, tightening of air ducts and things like that. So while we, the Department of Energy, have a credit program, and I don't disagree with you, I've actually made this somewhat of an impassioned statement at the Revenue Committee during the interim, is that there's a whole part of Oregon society that while the energy credit program is extremely important for those who can take advantage and use the credit program, there are many Oregonians who do not have that opportunity because they don't have a credit exposure or tax liability. And so one of the things that could be worked on in the state of Oregon, if you really want to get that umbrella covering all of Oregonians, is to try to figure out how do you develop a strategy that supports those people who can ill afford to pay for power but have no other alternatives because they can't access the programs that are currently available for people who have tax obligations.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Nathanson, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're starting to stray just a little bit from the purpose of this bill, but because we're talking about residential energy and how to help people who are living in their homes, I wanted to add a couple of thoughts. I've asked questions of other people before, but while you're here, I guess I want to state it in this venue as well. Sometimes we come to recognize that different agencies in the state are doing something that is related to what another department or agency is doing, that they're either working at cross purposes or they're not completely aligned to reach the same objective. And so when I think about the role of the Public Utility Commission in facilities or in rates, and then when I think about your presentation today, Department of Energy, Business Department, and then I think about Housing and Community Services, at some point I have no idea who would be responsible because each of you is responsible for a different piece of turf. But at some point, I'd like an analysis of what are the 5 or 10 or 25 different either incentive programs or prohibitions or regulations that all impact a simple decision about how can we make energy more affordable, for example. What are we doing in one place that is either helping or hindering the work that's being done in another place? And one very small example that this committee heard a few days ago, so I won't state it in detail, but over half of the community that I live in, people live in it's renter-occupied housing, not owner-occupied. Well, in some cases, the people who own the home can very well afford to weatherize, but they don't. It's just not in their economic interest to do that, but the people who are living there can't afford the energy. It's the trade-off between heat and food or heat and going to the pharmacy for some medication, for example. So how do incentive programs, for example, help address this larger issue of maybe we're helping only half the population, and how can we do something that helps the others who are actually in the least able to help themselves.
Representative Nathan, you are correct. That is a hugely important issue, but it is a bit off topic. And since we do have, not that I don't think it's important, because I do, But I'm going to suggest we move to Co-Chair Reed, and then we'll move to the 12 folks who have signed up to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe I can be somewhat helpful in trying to bridge back from Representative Nathanson's good comments to some of what we're talking about today. And I do that by noting the connection in the strategies we're talking about and the economic benefits. When we're able to reduce the use of energy, that reduces people's the costs to business and homeowners. When we're able to supply that energy from local sources, that's also to our benefit. I really want to pick up on something Representative Widener said and echo your identification of the problems of access to these sorts of programs for people who are of more modest means. That was one of the concerns that was raised during the hearing on the Main Street bill that had a $5,000 minimum. So I certainly recognize that and appreciate that concern. And since no one else raised it, I'm happy to remind some of the committee here had a hand in working on House Bill 2626 last session, EAST, the Energy Efficiency and Sustainable Technology Act, which is aimed specifically at the problem that we've identified here around helping people get access to credit to do the kinds of weatherization projects and then able to pay it back on their utility bills over time. So it is absolutely an important issue. One to which I expect we will return, and especially important to our economy and the general discussion about the Betsy at home, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
If I may add one thing, and just to add on to what Co-Chair Reed is talking about, and I would encourage you to always consider this, that this Betsy is used to create jobs,
right,
and those jobs help to remedy that situation. So, and we can show through the use of these Betsys, through an implant economic tool, that these have created over 12,000 jobs for Oregonians. So it doesn't reduce power costs. There is no simple answer to power reduction costs. But it does create jobs and enable people to pay for that power.
Thank you, Mr. Director. And Mr. Director, excuse me, just a moment. Representative Widener.
If I may, one final statement. The only reason this became a big issue for me, we have the city of McMinnville, where their power rates are half the price because they have their own local utility of every other city in the county. We put regulations with the Betsy and lots of different things like that, and a lot of those things are driving the cost of power up. We give an okay for PGE, other companies to go ahead and raise the rates, but we never go back and look at it. And they're happy for the mandates because I would rather make 20% on $200 than 20% on $100. So these are policies that I want us to look at really closely. I know it's something that we don't deal with in this committee, but I think it's something as a legislature we need to look at really closely because there's a lot of families that are being hurt out there.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you. We have a number of folks signed up, and I'm going to call upon three of them, Glenn Montgomery, David Brown, Doris Penwell, if you could come up. And I would just point out that we're down to about 40 minutes. And to avoid the unfortunate sight of Representative Greenlich coming through the door very angry and upset, I'm going to limit everyone to 3 minutes.
And you can deploy your co-chair if you need to go around and stand and loom over the over them if they're ready.
Thank you for that all. Actually,
we need a clock, Mr. Chair, that the folks can see too.
A light.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you signs when there's.
I'll raise my hand at 1 minute left.
Okay, good. All right. Who wants to go first?
Sure. Good afternoon, Representative Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. OSEA is the trade group for the solar industry in Oregon, established 30 years ago in 1981. And we represent a diverse constituency that spans the spectrum from sole proprietor who's on a rooftop installing residential solar to our largest manufacturer, Solar World, and everything in between, professional services, legal, financial, nonprofit organizations. So we have a very diverse membership, all advocating for the solar industry in Oregon. I was instructed that to set the context for the larger discussion, and I think Representative Reed invited that in his earlier comments. And my written testimony, in fact, is more congruent with the larger discussion around the Betsy and clean energy finance than it is with the particular bill that we are talking about today, House Bill 2414 and 2523. However, I'm happy to comment on that as well. But what I would like to suggest is that the clean energy finance, you may have noticed there was an op-ed in the paper today in the Oregonian, and I would encourage you to read that. There are members of our Clean Energy Finance Coalition that authored that particular op-ed. And it refers back to President Obama's discussion and his reference to a Sputnik moment. In Oregon, we're talking about Oregon's Sputnik moment. We have created a program that has been wildly successful in generating jobs and revenue for the state of Oregon, and in particular, the renewable energy industry, that has been a bright star in a very cloudy economic sky over the last few years. This is one of the few industries that has actually expanded instead of contracting, which is the fact for most of the industries in our state and across the nation. So while we are struggling to try to figure out how to balance a budget, while we are struggling to figure out how do we get people out of their homes and back to work, we're doing that right now, and in large part, it's because of what we've been able to do from a public investment standpoint. The Betsy has been the best tool that we can use to incent manufacturers to plant their roots here, to get people out in deploying renewable energy technology and energy efficiency technology, to help us get the needle pointing away from fossil fuels and more in the direction of renewables, which is where the state has committed itself. So we've got this incentive program that married with the RPS that is a much more effective means of mitigating climate change and also spurring on economic development. So it's my suggestion that as we continue this dialogue, that we look at the specific needs of continuing a program that supports clean energy finance. I'd like to extend the sunsets of the tax credits. I'd like to argue for lifting the cap, which creates an environment of uncertainty and does not allow investors to comfortably come to the table and say that they are willing to put their money in the game in supporting renewable energy in Oregon. And there are a couple of other things that we can talk about, and I don't want to take up all of the time. I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'm happy to answer questions at the next opportunity.
And thank you for keeping your remarks within the 3 minutes.
Sure.
It's Mr. Brown. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Thank you. David Brown with Obsidian Renewables, chairs and members of the committee. I'm also a proud member of OSEA and was happy to hear Glenn's comments. I'm going to try to be extremely brief. There is a discussion underway about how to support the transition of renewable energy going forward, and my company is participating in that and eager to share what we know. As a solar developer, we also do some renewable energy and some energy efficiency financing on some programs that are developing. We finance some of the FIT projects that are coming underway, and so we think we have a lot to contribute to that discussion. And we think that the subsidy program, the support programs that we have, can be re-engineered to be a little smarter, to work a little better, to be more predictable, and to eliminate some of the dissatisfaction that I think people around the table feel about those programs. Thank you.
Well, Doris is getting ready to testify. We're going to be looking forward to the specifics of that re-engineering in about, well, as soon as Doris is done. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Bentz and Representative Reed and committee members. I'm happy to be here. My name is Doris Penwell, and am I too loud here? And I'm representing both the Association of Counties and the Community Renewable Energy Association. That latter entity is made up of public and private entities that are trying to develop community-sized projects in Oregon. We're here today to testify on this bill because we are highly supportive of extending the Betsy for recruitment and expansion of manufacturing projects in Oregon. But we also believe in order to be successful in the manufacturing of renewable energy products, we also need the development and conservation programs as well, and they need to be supported by Oregon public policy. So So the point I'm making is that they go together. They're not separate entities, and you can be sure that we wouldn't have any manufacturing plants here of renewable energy products if we hadn't done the RPS and the BETSI program in 2007 and started developing different kinds of energy. As with Glenn Montgomery, the comments I'd like today to make are just in three little areas. We really do need to extend the sunset on all of these programs, and if we need to make some other adjustments, that's certainly good to consider, but we need some surety that these programs will be here. And also, we really want to encourage you to lift the cap that has been placed this biennium on the projects. We're now down to developing more community-sized projects, and the cap now is just about used up, so all of the projects that we're moving ahead that have been making application are now kind of dead in the water, and we're not going to be generating any more projects until the legislature decides what to do with this whole program. And with regard to moving the manufacturing program to Business Oregon, we really don't have any position except to say that they have to work hand-in-hand with the Department of Energy about how they process these projects. For instance, who is handling the pass-through program that's connected to the BETSI, things like that, so that we don't have different kinds of programs in different agencies in the state. The one final thing I guess I'd like to say is that with the smaller projects that are now being developed and trying to go forward, they really are great for Oregon because it brings the investment into the community and it usually stays there for reducing energy costs and improving job creation. And in addition to that, in terms of the metrics of what they do bring to Oregon, both the large and the small, I know most of you know that there is a study going on at the Department of Energy that should be back to you sometime in the next month or so to give you an idea about, with the investment we've made to date, what kind of job creation, et cetera, is being has come as a result of this huge program that we have, so that you have a more comforting idea about where to go for the future. Thanks so much, and we'll be back again.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, right now we have three bills that are being discussed right now. We have 2414, 2523, and 2524. And you, I think each of you said you're speaking to this bill. I just want to clarify which bill you were speaking to.
I can answer that from my standpoint. We are speaking to both, at least the first two bills, if not the third. They all have to do with continuing use of the BETSI for the renewable energy programs, both manufacturing and the alternative vehicle program. There is no bill in the legislature right now that extends sunsets for the BETSI program, particularly of development, other than what might be considered in one of these kinds of bills. So, and we feel they go together. So that's why this issue is being raised today, beyond just manufacturing.
Representative Bentz, Representative Reed, Representative Lindsay, and members of the committee, I was not, and I specifically said I wasn't testifying to these bills, rather setting the context for the larger discussion. I am happy to comment on 2414 and 2523. Generally, I'm in favor of moving the manufacturing BETSI to the Oregon Business Development Department. In fact, because that particular tool is being used in large part for an economic development purpose for the recruitment of companies. And it would make sense to house that in that organization. Having said that, regardless of where the program resides, it merely has to be effectively administered. So that is my main concern. And if the coordination, if ODO is coordinating with the Business Development Department and they're working together as they are today, I'm perfectly happy having it stay where it is.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the appetite for venture capitalists? Are they jumping in And if so, are they jumping in because of the credits? If they're not jumping in, why are they not?
Chairs, Representative Lindsay, the venture capital community first prefers technology applications and technology opportunities, and so aspects involving improving efficiency of solar panels, improving efficiency of inverters, improving sort of the next thing that will make renewable energy competitive is where venture capitalists tend to have their focus, more on discovery items as opposed to manufacturing.
Let me just interrupt you there. I'm specifically addressing 2524, which is extending the sunset for alternative fuel vehicles.
Yes.
So if you could narrow the scope of your answer to that, Bill.
The alternative vehicle fuels is an example of that kind of discovery technology. We need, as exciting as the Nissan Leaf is and the Chevy Volt, their limitation on range is a huge limiting factor in popularity with respect to some of the combined engines that use alternative fuels or diesel fuels. The opportunity for discovery to get to 70 miles a gallon, 75 miles a gallon, is the kind of thing that's exciting to venture capitalists, yes. And the state's support of it is vital because other states have support programs as well, and the location of those manufacturers is a very competitive process.
Well,
yeah. Actually, a couple follow-ups, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
It is, but we still have eight folks to go.
Sure,
so
you bet. Could adequate results be achieved if we were to lower the percentage of the credit?
Chairs, Representative Lindsay, for me that question would have to be splintered into the different kinds of technologies that we're talking about. I think that the committee decided last February that with respect to wind, there was a certain maturity in that technology that allowed the support to be reduced. Those of us in solar are very eager for that day to come for solar. Right now, I would say alternative fuel vehicles are not quite there, but when that curve bends, then I think they'll get there fairly quickly. I think once we know how to do it, the need to support the continued development of it will be reduced very rapidly.
And final question is, when is the expected timeline?
Committee Chairs, Representative Lindsay, with respect to which technology?
Alternative fuel.
I'm not qualified to answer that because I don't know exactly where we are on the discovery timeline. I'm sorry, I'm just not sure.
Mr. Chair, could I just make
Please.
One final comment about the reducing the amount? I think for any of these technologies, reducing the amount is something you can consider, but it goes along with the other provisions to make it effective as a tax credit. So you can't just talk about that by itself. It goes with the other considerations that might be before us as we move through here.
Thank you. Representative Leitner.
Thank you, Chair. Since we have the solar guys up here, and we're talking about moving technology, I thought Representative Lindsay was going to get to this one. But how efficient are solar panels right now, and how much have they improved over the last 5 years?
Chair Benson Reed, Representative Widener, members of the committee. Solar panels range in efficiency anywhere from 18 to 22%. There are varying technologies, of course. There's thin film technologies, there's polycrystalline and monocrystalline, and to get into the weeds would be not a fruitful discussion. The relative change in efficiency over the last year or 5 years, I don't have specific data to provide for you there, but clearly there's much room and much R&D that is underway working on those efficiencies through a variety of technologies, not just the panels themselves, but in the ways that we track the sun, etc. So was there a second part to that question? Those were the two parts.
I just Does wanted that the efficiencies.
Okay.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next three are Larry Scruggs, Lynn Cannon, Link Cannon, and Dan Bates. And I'll reemphasize the 3 minutes. Whoever goes over that, I'm going to have address the next chair. Yes, right. Coming through the door.
It's hard to represent.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go ahead and go first.
Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Scruggs. I'm representing Tax Apprentice Oregon. We're here to talk about House Bills 2414 and 2523, and then if it pleases the chair, we'd like to make some general comments about the Betsy program, if we could. The bills appear to be identical, and we really don't see much difference where it goes as long as the transparency is maintained and you can still get the information. We're more than happy with it whichever way it goes. But we don't think that's the bigger issue. Our concern is not where the program is placed, but where the subsidy design is appropriate in the first place. We're concerned that the capital costs are a critical issue to the business people when they come, but we're not sure that that's the most critical issue for the taxpayers to take into consideration. We understand that when you construct a facility, it creates jobs, but the equipment that's purchased to go into those facilities usually comes from outside of Oregon, and that money does not go to the state of Oregon itself. With the current design based on capital costs with a cap, we seem to be providing $20 million in subsidy no matter how many jobs the Betsy is actually creating or the company is creating. And it also doesn't seem to make much difference whether the facility costs $40 million, $400 million, or $4 billion. The subsidy appears to be about the same. Let's use the subsidy of solar power in Wilsonville as one case in point, if I may. Oregon is promising $40 million. That's 73% of the total construction cost, $20 million in SELP loans and $20 million in Betsy money, to build a $55 million facility. That's 73% of the total cost to build a facility. That provides a total public investment of $235,000 per job created, and we're a little concerned about that. The taxpayers are taking an enormous risk but get little return for the investment, and we'd like to see the state of Oregon, if it makes this kind of investment, to be able to get some kind of equity stake in the company itself so that the return on the investment continues over an extended periods of time. We were very happy to hear that the directors mentioned that they did not provide funding to the company that we read about in the New York Times a few weeks ago, where they took a $43 million investment from the state of Massachusetts. And while they were going through that application process, they were planning to move their plants to China. We were very glad to hear that that didn't happen here. Using Betsy alone, Oregon will pay $118,000 per job for the $170 jobs that are promised. Assuming above average salaries, let's say a gross salary, not gross payroll, but gross salary of $70,000 a year, that'll generate a personal income tax in Oregon of about $4,200 per job. That's a payback period of 30 years just to recover that. And if you're using that money to recover the Betsy, then you're not using it to pay for the public services that those people and then that company will be using. We understand that there may be additional phases of development, and that's part of the bait, but each of those phases will undoubtedly seek an additional subsidy because that's the part of the process. That's the way it works. Our subsidies for traded sector manufacturing jobs cannot expect much in the way of business taxes since we tax on the Oregon sales alone.
Mr. Scruggs, your 3 minutes has expired.
Okay.
So I take it you're, in a nutshell, opposed to the Betsy.
No, we're not opposed to Betsy's in general, but we think there needs to be a correlation between the amount we spend and the number of jobs that we get, or the amount that we spend and the number of BTUs that we save, because there's a huge range, and we think that range needs to be smaller.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Benz, Representative Reed, members of the committee, Dan Bates with Foreign Run Partners representing today actually two companies, Ecotality and Revolt Technologies, two good stories that I'm happy to report on. The first is Ecotality. You have a letter in front of you from their Vice President for Government Relations, which is a company based in San Francisco that is involved in the rollout of electric vehicle infrastructure in six states in the District of Columbia, including Oregon. And knowing that we're having a global discussion in about these tax credits and the tough choices that you all face, I would simply say with Ecotality that its investment in Oregon, as well as Department of Energy's investment in Oregon, is directly based on the electric vehicle ecosystem that many people in Oregon have worked to build over the years, including the utilities, the state government, in generating that environment. The tax credit that we're discussing today is involved in that incentive. And I think the discussions with regard to when the market has reached the point where the subsidy is no longer needed and the size of that subsidy is certainly worth a discussion, and we'd be happy to be involved in that. And other states are going through those similar discussions with regard to EVs, EV infrastructure, EV manufacturing. So we welcome a discussion on that point. The second story, quickly, in the time that I have remaining, is a company, Revolt Technologies, which is now an Oregon company that was attracted in part because of the BETSI credit it received from Switzerland and has moved its global headquarters to Oregon. It's a next-generation battery company in metal air. And they were included in a number of different incentives. They will employ by 2015 160 people, roughly, at about an average wage of $80,000. We're predicting, you know, four or five years in the future, and so those are the predictive numbers. And Revolt has been involved and engaged. They've now are renovating the facilities in Portland. They're hiring folks. They'll hopefully have 25 employees by the end of this year. And it's a story in which, not the BETSI that we're actually discussing the two bills today, there are research and development and demonstration BETSI, although look very closely at the manufacturing BETSI, and we're engaged in that. And actually would note that in one of the provisions, there's a discussion about batteries in the manufacturing, which would probably be a topic of discussion for another day that Revolt would care about. But a great story about how the BETSI, in part, helped attract a company that was looking at a number of other states and frankly, around the world, and ended up choosing Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Bates. Mr. Cannon.
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Link Cannon. I'm here representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC is an association of most large timber landowners and many large forest products manufacturing firms in the state. I have a number of comments here relative to the biomass and its relationship to BETSI and biomass renewable projects. I'm not going to go through a lot of those. I do want to hit a couple high points and then respond to a couple points that have been raised by the committee. We do have a number of members that have utilized the BETSI and non-members, folks in Forest Products Committee community. The BETSI has been very successful in helping folks like Seneca and Eugene, Rough and Ready and Cave Junction, Ferris Lumber up to Sandy Am Canyon here, as well as a number of smaller community scale and small scale biomass facilities. DOE has a list of those, and there are a lot of biomass facilities that have been created as a result of BETSI investments. Thank you. And we believe there are still significant opportunities. So my comments here are directed not to the specific bills before you, but we are a member of the Clean Energy Financing Group, and my comments are along the lines that Mr. Montgomery mentioned just generally in discussing the BETSI. I did want to mention biomass facilities among renewable technologies do have some attributes that some of the other renewables don't. In particular, they create long-term sustainable jobs in addition to construction jobs, because biomass facilities require fuel. Someone has to go out in the woods and get them, process them, and deliver them to the facilities where they're burned. So
That is for rural communities that have those kinds of facilities, that's very important. And the other is this biomass facilities in the electricity world provide baseload energy, which means they can run 24/7, which means you don't need to have gas generators or other thing backing up their capacity. Representative Nathan, to go to my two other points that were raised by legislators, Representative Nathanson mentioned the alignment issue or the question of different things being in different places and how do you put that all together. The governor Monday announced a Forest Products Energy Study Project, which is a cooperative effort of the Department of Energy, Department of Forestry, Business Oregon, and Energy Trust to do exactly that. They want to do strategic investments. They will be taking applications starting soon. The first phase of this is feasibility and engineering studies. They'll have those done by October 31st, and then they intend to identify 6 to 12 projects to move forward with and looking at project planning and financing. So that is taking place within, and we think the Betsy's could be an important part of that going forward. And one other thing, if I could, to Representative Smith's question about jobs, out-of-state jobs versus homegrown jobs. The biomass industry is a homegrown industry, and the jobs that are created through these investments are homegrown jobs. And so retained jobs and new jobs in rural communities that are created by in-state companies are still economic investment, whether the money comes from somebody outside or somebody in-state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, panel. And if you have any questions, they better be really short.
I just want to say in response, yeah, I think a job's a job, right? My question is in terms of the housing, and there's various questions, but in terms of the housing, do you want it the recruitment department or do you want it not necessarily the recruitment department?
Thank you.
The last panel is going to be a panel of four, Marion Haynes, Jody Weiser, Mike Dewey, and Joe Esmond. They all come on.
Esmond.
Sorry, Joe.
Mr. Co-Speaker.
Go ahead. You get a promotion.
I did.
I'll just wait.
You deserve it. Who wants to go first?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Reed and Bentz. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm representing Portland General Electric, and I'm speaking to House Bill 2524, the electric vehicles. Just wanted to emphasize that we have worked in partnership with Ecotality, who you heard from, and the state of Oregon, in really working to make Oregon a leader in the electric vehicle market. From our perspectives, it addresses a number of priorities for the state, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions, dependence on foreign oil, and it will, from our perspective, help in developing emerging smart grid applications down the road as the technology continues to develop. Working with the state, PGE has signed partnership agreements with Nissan, Ford, and Mitsubishi to make Portland a key launch market for EVs. Oregon was one of six states chosen to participate in a national EV project designed to build and study a mature charge infrastructure. That work is being led by Ecotality. Our collaborative approach here has also resulted in addition to the EV project, Oregon has received millions of dollars in federal funding to install several dozen quick charge stations, and we actually have the first publicly available quick charge station located at our headquarters in Portland. So I think the tax credit that we've been able to give is fairly modest. We could talk about the sum of that. The penetration rates that we're expecting in EVs aren't huge in the coming years, and so, but this does really establish Oregon as a leader in this arena, and we think that continuing commitment to that going forward is important. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike. Thank you very much, Mike Dewey, for the record, representing Waste Management, Think Green. Waste Management in Oregon operates two solid waste landfills, collects pretreasable waste and recoverables at the curb, and we have material recovery facilities. What I wanted to do real quickly is talk about the opportunities that Waste Management has in Oregon. And this deals with, on the landfill side, being able to take methane and putting in the fueling station whereby the trucks that we utilize at the landfill wouldn't use diesel but the landfill gas, which is a great opportunity. In the Portland area where we have literally hundreds of trucks on the road, what we're looking at is putting in a compressed natural gas station, fueling station, which is very, very expensive. And if you go to compressed natural gas compared to diesel, the greenhouse gas emissions are literally zero. The problem we have in the Portland area is because of the franchise system, if we're 40% of the market and we're rate regulated on the residential side, for every dollar we spend, and I'll make this real simple, we only get 40 cents back in the rates. So we're going to want to do the right thing, but one of the issues is whether or not it makes any sense on the financial side. It clearly makes sense on the environmental side. And we do operate in Southern California, the San Diego area, and Seattle with these kind of trucks, but it's a very, very big investment. And as we talk about tax credit, that's something we would look at in order for us to make these what we consider very good environmental investments. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Joe.
For the record again, Joe Wesman, IBEW 48. I just want to speak again, echoing a lot of what Ms. Haynes said. The IBEW has been involved with this from the ground floor, working with PGE, with PSU, City of Portland, and ODOT to help provide some base information and a trained workforce to go ahead and do that. Every electrician who's in the state who has a state license, a commercial license, can install those charging stations so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. And I just want to say also, in 2007, we spoke up for the manufacturing Betsy for Solar World. It was an example, and it produced 150 construction jobs, roughly for about 8 to 16 months. Very good partner to work with. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I wish we had more time for questions, but yes,
Mr. Wagner. For Miriam, real fast, how many wind turbines have you guys put up over the last 5 years with the Betsy?
I'll have to get back to you on that answer. Obviously, the Bigelow Canyon wind project used the Betsy's for some phases, but I don't believe for the last one. I think that was changed when they made the amendments to it in the 2009 session. So I'll have to get back to you on that answer.
If also you can bring me how much of rates went up in the last 5 years, too, so with the increased power that's been put online, and how much is staying in Oregon and how much is going to other states, too, with that renewable energy. So you can bring those to me offline.
Okay.
May I have a bit on that question,
please,
Mr. Co-Speaker?
95% of the windmills the windmills installed were performed by Oregon workers. So those money at a good rate, and especially in those communities on the east that could really use that extra income in the hotels and the restaurants. I can't give you your number. That's just my.
Well, that my question. What I know, Oregon people install them. That wasn't my question.
Further questions? Just one, Mike, for you. The concept of the natural gas conversion. Have you been receiving, or have you applied for a Betsy credit for that? Is that something that fits within our current program?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe it would, and depending on the conversion, we haven't because we're just in the, because the company is moving in this direction, we're having very serious conversations about getting into either the methane side on the landfill or the compressed natural gas, you know, within the city of Portland and the urban areas. But we don't have any projects in the works at this point in time. I understand we have a go in the Portland area to make these investments. It's just kind of, and we think there's an opportunity, quite frankly, with Metro, in that Metro is the planner on the solid waste side. So we might be able to reduce the tip fees for companies that make these investments, for example. So there are other ways we can go about this. We just have to be creative, because this is where I think the industry has to go, but a number of companies aren't going to make that investment because they're pretty massive.
Thank you. Yes, Representative White.
If I may, for Mr. Dewey, are they looking at cogen plants at all? Because, I mean, with that methane, it's right there, it's compressed, you do it all in one location, and it's putting more power online, especially if we're looking at electric vehicles and stuff. That makes more sense to me than trying to do it for vehicles, because vehicles are mobile, and where do I fill up if I don't have one on the other end of the state? Is the problem you run into there?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, the issue, I mean, at the River Bend landfill near McMinnville and the large landfill in Eastern Oregon, we do sell power to the McMinnville Power Company. And then we have an agreement, because so much of the solid waste comes by train from the Seattle region, we sell electricity to the Seattle Power and Light. So we already do that. The question really is, what's the highest and best use? And literally, this is changing dramatically. We have, I'll do this very quickly. We are now siting, we're almost finished with our siting of an S4 facility, which is a plasmification facility, at the landfill in Eastern Oregon, and it's a pilot. And at the end, you have no residual, and you have high-end fuels, like jet fuels. And you could do this in communities, for example. Ours is at 25 tons a day in terms of the pilot. And this is really, you know, high-tech stuff. You don't burn it, but if you took the equivalent of what the temperature would be, it's 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit. You just change the atoms around.
Extremely interesting, but we want to get Jody on the record before we're out of time. Jody?
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. If we understand 2524 right, what we're doing is ending the subsidy of alternative energy devices with this bill and extending the sunset for electric vehicles. And if that's true, that makes some sense. And we would urge you that in another bill to look at ways to increase the efficacy of our subsidies in conservation as well, because we've seen, as we've looked at individual programs, a lot of areas that need tightening in order to truly meet goals in an efficient way. But today I wish to speak specifically to continuing taxpayer subsidy of electric vehicles for another 6 years. Amongst the questions you were asked to consider in deciding whether to extend tax credits or not were these: what's the public policy purpose of this credit? Who directly benefits from the credit? Is use of the tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve the policy goal? And what is expected to happen if this credit fully sunsets? Those are some of the questions that came to you from the Tax Credit Committee. Well, the public policy purpose of the electric vehicle portion of this bill hasn't been stated, but if the purpose is to encourage Oregonians to lead the nation in the purchase of electric vehicles, then we think that the subsidy is unnecessary. There's zero proof that our appetite for purchasing Priuses and other hybrid vehicles is because we had a subsidy. Rather, we think it's the nature of our citizens to be green, and that nature doesn't have to have a subsidy to be encouraged. In fact, Oregon has one of the highest renewable portfolio standards in the nation. It's the leader in voluntarily purchasing at higher costs, at a premium, electric energy that is green. In fact, PGE has more renewable power customers than any other utility in the United States. So these are people who are saying, we'll pay more. We want to be green. And they're actually paying more, not asking for a handout to do that. So we don't see how this subsidy is important. Nissan chose to roll out their vehicle in states based upon anticipated demand, not on subsidy. In fact, 55% of the Nissan Leafs were that they got the $99 from people came from Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, and Tennessee. Yes.
That's 1 minute left.
Pardon me?
Just 1 minute left.
Oh, thanks. So we think that actually increasing the subsidy and continuing it for another 6 years amounts to government waste, and we shouldn't really be considering doing that. Who benefits from the credit? People who buy expensive cars, people who can afford to buy expensive cars, people who will buy these cars anyway. The Nissan Leafs were fully signed up for in September for the cars that were going to roll out the end of December. Is the tax and a credit an efficient and effective way to achieve the policy goal? Well, when we look at the statistics, not for EVs, but for the vehicles that were purchased in between 2001 and 2009, we found that 56% of the projects were pass-through projects, whereas 44 were not. So most of these people are selling their tax credits. So having a tax credit rather than a direct grant, if you're going to do the program, doesn't really make sense. 70% of the pre-certified costs were going to be sold. That's because most of the purchases were by government agencies, nonprofits, businesses that didn't have a tax appetite. And so why don't we say, if we're going to give to them something, let's give them a smaller amount, and let's give them the dollars at the door when they're purchasing the car or with a check shortly thereafter, and not stop wasting 27 cents on the dollar with pass-through partners. And
I have to let you go there because we have to leave five okay. minutes before the hour, or Representative Greenlink will come through that door, I guarantee it, in 30 seconds. But thank you very much for your yeah. thoughts. And are there questions for this panel? Yes.
No question, but just a comment, Mr. Yes. Chair. Joey, I wanted to thank you. You had me worried there at the beginning. I thought you were going to be supportive of a bill. And there are some things I count on, so thank you very much.
I did support a piece of that bill.
Thank you
very much, panel. And with that, we're closing the public hearing on 2414, 2523, and 2524. And with that, we're adjourned.